You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 26th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And it was on this date, January 29th in 1886, that Carl Benz applied for a patent for his Benz Patent Motor Wagon, a three-wheeler vehicle with a gasoline engine. This is recognized today as the birth of the internal combustion gasoline-powered automobile.
Benz, where have I heard that name before?
Let's see, I don't know.
I know a Ben. Wait.
Mercedes?
Oh, you meant the car.
Mercedes-Benz.
What year was that?
Not that classy.
1886.
Talk about a world-changing patent.
Yeah, oh yeah.
How do you figure?
But it was only three wheels? What's up with that?
Yeah, I didn't know it was three wheels. It's very stable.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
I guess that's all.
Did he call it a horseless carriage?
No, he didn't. It was the motor wagon or motorwagen.
The motorwagen.
Das Auto.
All right, guys, let's talk geeky science. What do we got?
Well, we're going to start by remembering Jack LaLanne. You guys remember him, right?
Jack.
Absolutely.
We're going to miss you. I didn't know he was still alive.
He died a few days ago at the age of 96 of pneumonia. Got to die of something, right? But he was in great shape right up until the end.
Yeah, he was fantastic. I remember watching him as a kid. I remember being like having that experience where somebody was exercising and it wasn't really the norm at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really was the first. I mean, he was well ahead of his time in promoting just general – I mean, wasn't it what, just general exercising and healthful diet? Then going back to – was it the 1930s or 40s? I mean, he was literally decades ahead of his time. Really, really amazing.
The real thing that he innovated was incorporating weight training into just standard exercising for health, which at the time – was not the conventional wisdom. The thinking was that excessive weight training would make you over bulky or would make women seem masculine and wasn't good for athletes and wasn't necessary or good for overall health. But he really pushed that. And in fact, he developed some weight training equipment and really promoted the idea that you should weight train on a regular basis, not just cardiovascular training. And the research has borne him out over the years. You know, especially as we get older, we could maintain our muscle mass and a lot of our functionality by incorporating some weight training. So he definitely was ahead of his time as far as that's concerned.
He utilized a fascinating new medium at the time called television.
Yes.
Remember those black get his message out.
Those black and white shows with Jack LaLanne in his unitard, which I don't know why that became his look. But I can't imagine him not wearing a unitard.
You know, the one thing about Jack LaLanne that I always respected is that he never really went for the big sellout. Like, he didn't put his face on every product and really use his celebrity to make money, especially hawking products that probably he wouldn't have believed in anyway.
So I had that question about Jack LaLanne. I wanted to look into that a little bit deeper because I was curious. Like, did he ever get into any of the dubious stuff? I found that reading extensive interviews with him, et cetera, looking at his own website, I could buy about 70 to 80% of what he was for. And he had a lot. He basically had a very no-nonsense approach, which I liked. He basically said, "You're in charge of your own life. You're in charge of your own body. Stop making excuses. Just get up and do it. Exercise, eat right, and that's that sort of basic common sense approach. Now we think of it as a common sense approach to health, and I really do appreciate that. He also, like in an interview, he was asked about organic foods, and his response was, "It's a bunch of bull. How do you know what's really organic?" And then he goes on to explain, why it's nonsense, the whole notion of the impurities and whatnot. Although part of his thinking was that if you exercise enough, you'll get rid of any toxins, so don't worry about it, which I'm not sure if that's exactly how I would state it. Now, I also was very interested in what he thought about supplements. He doesn't did not sell on his website any supplements. The only real marketing thing he sold was the Jack LaLanne Power Juicer. So he was a big advocate of eating lots of raw fruits and vegetables and juicing them as a way of getting, more raw fruits and vegetables into your diet, which is fine. He was largely a vegetarian, although did eat fish, did get his protein from fish, liked to limit dairy. So he wasn't too freaky about the food. He basically just avoid things that have a lot of calories, eat a lot of fruits and vegetables to get good nutrition. That's okay. I mean, I think he maybe took it a little bit too far, but that was all okay. But he did say in this interview that he took like 40 supplements a day and a whole bunch of herbs and stuff, which there's really no evidence for general health or for preventing anything, unless you have very specific medical conditions or situations. And also, if you're eating tons of fruits and vegetables, you don't need to take vitamin supplements. You're getting the vitamins in all the fruits and vegetables that you're eating. So I really, you know, I wouldn't go along with that. He also, you know, I think that his can-do and personal responsibility approach, I really like, but he took that a little bit too far in that. For example, in an interview, he was asked specifically about a woman who in her 60s developed ovarian cancer. And his response is, she must have been doing something wrong, something unhealthy. As if, yeah, so I, no, so his philosophy was, if you did sort of exercise and eat right and treated your body well, then you would never get sick, which, you know, he was lucky enough to get to 96, you know, before getting any serious illness. But that's kind of, you know, blaming people for illnesses that really are no fault of your own. You know, sometimes you could do everything right and still just through bad luck or your genetics or whatever get hit with ovarian cancer or some disease like that. You know, you can't have total control over your health. So I think he took that personal responsibility philosophy that one step too far to, you know, blaming people for anything medically bad that happened to them, when in fact that's just not what the evidence says. But overall, I mean, he was definitely, you know, again, had a very, I think, basic good approach to health. Eat right, exercise regularly, do some weight training, get good nutrition. He was way ahead of his time as far as that was concerned.
And wear unitards.
And wear unitards, absolutely. So we'll definitely miss Jack. Bob, we have another stunning cold fusion claim that's about to revolutionize the energy infrastructure of the entire world.
Oh, good.
Yeah, our old friend cold fusion is back in the news again. And unfortunately, he probably stinks as bad as he did last time. My favorite headline about this topic recently was from Popular Science. It said, Italian scientists claim, and then in parentheses, dubious cold fusion breakthrough. I really like that a lot of these treatments in the news are just pretty much like, yeah, here we go again type of attitude, which it really deserves. The idea here is that two Italian scientists, Sergio Foccardi and Andrea Rossi of the Physics Department of the University of Bologna, claim that they've created a cold fusion reactor that uses nickel and hydrogen. Now, I had to chuckle when I read that they're from the University of Bologna. It was very kind of apropos. Now, in case you forgot, cold fusion is a hypothetical room temperature reaction that joins two smaller nuclei into one bigger nucleus, which releases energy, hopefully more than it took to get them together. Now, hot fusion, on the other hand, in which high temperatures and pressures cause fusion, is not hypothetical. It's what powers the sun, after all, and we've been trying to pull that off for decades ourselves artificially.
Well, we have pulled off artificial fusion. That's what
fusion nukes.
Bomb is. Yeah, the trick is controlling it, exactly.
The control of it is where the real benefit comes from. And it's obviously very hard, very expensive, but we know it's real. So cold fusion then would be a good thing, right? It's not just easier, it's less expensive to pull off, but we're also talking about cheap, almost unlimited energy, minus a lot of the nasty radioactive byproducts and minus carbon emissions. I mean, this thing would be truly a boon to mankind. So, you know, if somebody pulled off the cold fusion trifecta, and by that I mean you prove cold fusion is real, you unequivocally demonstrate that fact, and you can make it scalable, then obviously our energy problems become essentially trivial. What would happen? You'd win a Nobel Prize. You get crazy rich and famous. And our robot descendants will be referring to you in about 100 years as one of those rare, bright meat bags.
Right.
So the temptation is certainly high to make cold fusion work. And it explains why some scientists to this day still pursue it, even when there's next to no real theoretical support for it. And even after not one experiment exists, after so many attempts, that's repeatable and shown to be a nuclear reaction and not a chemical one. So before the emails start flying, technically, there is a form of cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions that exists. Were you guys aware of this?
No.
It's undisputed and it's non-controversial. It's called muon catalyzed fusion. It's really, wasn't aware of this and it's fascinating. The process here uses muons, which are essentially electrons that are
derived from cows.
that's utterly ridiculous.
Oh boy, damn. Yeah, let's end that right now. They're about 200 times as massive as regular electrons. So if you could now replace these regular electrons with these muons in certain molecules, what would happen is that the muons would orbit the nearby nuclei more closely, forcing the nuclei closer together, which would cause spontaneous fusion at temperatures near room temperature much more readily. But the problem is, obviously, there's a problem here. The energy balance just doesn't work out. It's basically just too hard to make the muons, and they're not efficient.
So it's not a source, ultimately, of energy. It takes too much energy to make all this happen.
Absolutely. But if this changes, you know, with technology, you know, maybe we'll come up with a way to make these muons cheaply and to make them more efficient in doing what they would need to do. We could potentially, you know, have a form of cold fusion that is a potent source of energy and just, you know, not the crap that's been in the news for 22 years. So, all right, back to the meatbags. The reactor, their reactor that the scientists claim fuses atomic nuclei of nickel and hydrogen, producing copper and lots of energy, apparently. They further claim that with an investment of approximately about 400 watts, it yields the equivalent of 12,400 watts at the back end. Now, the scientists also estimate that once scaled up, this could translate to less than 1 cent, one American penny per kilowatt hour, which is considerably less than coal or natural gas plants. And so if that was true, that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, without any carbon, I would add.
All right, how do we evaluate this? How do we critically examine this? And I think it's important, especially in this case, to look at the gestalt. You know, get the view from 50,000 feet here. So what you do, or what I see when I look at this thing, is basically a sea of red flags all over the place. It's really amazing. And each flag essentially minimizes the likelihood that there's anything to this. So for me, number one, a huge red flag is the concept of cold fusion itself. I mean, it's seen by most mainstream scientists as theoretically implausible, if not downright impossible.
Now, Bob, in this case, and I spent a lot of time looking into this, they're claiming nickel plus hydrogen yields copper,
right,
plus heat plus radiation, right?
Right.
There, a lot of people are criticizing them because they didn't really produce data to support the fact that there's the radiation byproduct we would expect from fusion, nor did they provide details as to how they are sure that there's the copper byproduct that you would expect. But they are claiming that those things are present. But I was looking to answer one very specific question. Would, theoretically, nickel fusion into copper be exothermic or endothermic? Would it require energy or produce energy? And everything I could find says that it would require energy, that you wouldn't get energy out of it. Actually, I couldn't find any source that specifically addressed nickel plus hydrogen into copper. But what they do say is that fusion at iron and nickel or above, you know, to get essentially, if you need to go above nickel in the periodic table, is endothermic, requires energy input, because the binding energy of iron and nickel are pretty much the strongest of all the nuclei. And so some of the sources I found said that all of the fusion above nickel is endothermic. Some said that most is, and none specifically addressed fusion into copper. But it seems like this reaction, even if they could get it to occur, wouldn't produce energy.
Yeah, I found similar stuff, Steve. We probably went to a lot of the same website. Be that as it may, there's so many other pieces here. Like for number two, scientists, they haven't given us details on how the process works. Red flag right there. I mean, come on, give us something to work with here. They also said that they can't account for how the cold fusion is triggered. You know, you would think that they would have some idea, something to go on here. And it's just another big red flag. When they can't do that. And here's one that really irked the crap out of me. Their paper was rejected by several peer-reviewed scientific journals. So to me, this is a critical flaw. I mean, when you bypass peer review and you go straight to the media, your credibility just goes way, way down, and it's such a hallmark of pseudoscientists. And related to that, get this one, guys. Their paper was, it turns out, published in the Journal of Nuclear Physics, which is an online journal apparently and astoundingly founded by these two guys,
yeah.
Focardi and Rossi. I mean, can you even believe that?
They self-published.
What, what?
I found one website that said that they have a patent or a patent pending. In fact, from what I could tell, their patent application was rejected.
Yes.
Just totally rejected.
Right. So not only rejected by peer review, but rejected by the patent office because they just couldn't provide the data to explain how such an implausible process was happening. I'd also point out that in an interview, the researchers, you know, when they were asked about their lack of being able to convince the scientific community, they said again something which, you know, pegs them as dubious. They said that the marketplace will show that we're correct, not the scientific community. We're going to produce actual, you know, working, you know, units, and people will buy it, and that will determine it. That's crap. But the kernel of truth is that one of the criteria for, you know, having a plausible claim that should be taken seriously is that your process can be used, as you say, to scale up and produce actually large amounts of energy. So if they could produce a device that produced a ton of energy, you know, on an industrial scale, that I would find that at least interesting.
Absolutely. That was actually my 10th red flag, that they actually – the fact that they're actually claiming that their invention – can be used for industrial purposes, but the thing is, in several months, it's like they're on the cusp of producing these things. And
sounds like a pitch for money.
They're already
people send us money so we can complete our studies.
Right. So for me, this was a red flag because it just seems way too premature and very suspicious that they're just ready to do this. I mean, they haven't even been printed. You know, they haven't even been published in peer reviewed journals. Finally, it seems to me that. The other thing that really gets to me, if I were a scientist in 2011 and I believe that I really and truly invented a cold fusion reactor, I would think that I would think long and hard about the 22-year-old controversy over cold fusion.
Yeah.
It's been called the biggest controversy in science. The term cold fusion has been stigmatized to the point that scientists in the biz give it a different name. They rebranded it because it was so pathetic. Then you've got Pons and Fleischmann, who are considered jokes by many, and for one of the biggest fails in science in the past generation. So if I were going to jump into this fray as it is now, I just can't imagine not at least trying to address every red flag that we've been talking about here.
Yeah.
And the fact that these scientists don't seem to care how this announcement is perceived makes it overwhelmingly likely in my mind that they're either deluding themselves or they're outright scam artists. Now, I hope I'm wrong, and it's possible that I'm wrong, but if you got to go with the odds, that's what I'm going to choose. So the bottom line for me, I think Focardi and Rossi should just drink a lot of Martini and Rossi and forget about cold fusion.
All right, Bob. You know, Bob, the thing about this whole article that you're commenting on is I don't really know what you feel.
Well, let's go on. A recent Cochrane review of the use of statins in primary prevention of cardiovascular and other vascular disease was published about a week ago. And this is
Steve.
Yes.
What's a statin?
Yeah, I'm getting there. Hang on. This has caused some controversy. Now, part of this is because the statin drugs, these are drugs that are used to lower cholesterol, like simvastatin, for example. These are blockbuster drugs for many pharmaceutical companies. And they've been criticized by some who think that the pharmaceutical companies are trying to promote their sales by exaggerating the usefulness of their drugs, which, you know, sure. Yeah, drug companies try to make money. That's what they do. And the data has been like all medical data, right? It's not like you get one early definitive study and everybody knows what the answer is from the beginning. Usually you get, the evidence evolves and there's so many different ways you could look at the evidence. There's always, you know, some controversy about how to exactly interpret it. And also for background, the Cochrane Collaboration, this is an evidence-based medicine organization that, you know, reviews published data in order to make clinical recommendations. What does the data say about how we should be practicing medicine? So they published recently a review of using the use of statin drugs for primary prevention. Now, primary prevention means basically in people who are not symptomatic, have not had heart attacks or strokes, or don't have major symptoms of diseases that are risk factors for those for heart attacks or strokes. The use of statins in people who, for secondary prevention, in people with, for example, advanced cardiovascular disease, you know, atherosclerosis, or who have had a heart attack, or have had a stroke, that's much less controversial. I think that's basically non-controversial within mainstream science. The data there is fairly robust, although there are cholesterol skeptics. You know, cholesterol skeptics are like evolution skeptics. They are basically, in my opinion, is dedicated ideological anti-cholesterol group. But aside from them, there really isn't any legitimate controversy about the use of statins in patients who have advanced, you know, atherosclerotic disease. With all preventive measures, it's easier to measure the effectiveness in people who are at high risk for whatever the thing is that you're preventing. As the risk gets lower and lower and lower, it gets harder and harder to statistically and scientifically document that there's a preventive effect, right? It's hard to prevent something that's probably not going to happen anyway. So for people who are at really low risk for heart attacks and strokes, it shouldn't come as a surprise that there isn't a huge preventive effect from taking statins or from doing anything else for that matter. This study, this review, this Cochrane review is looking at those patients, patients who are at the lowest risk for heart attacks and strokes, and who have not had any symptomatic disease, therefore for primary prevention. And what's interesting is that what the data that they show from reviewing 14 different studies and thousands of patients, they essentially did like a meta-analysis, that the data that they show is actually pretty good and better than other previous systematic reviews of the data. They showed, in fact, that in this patient population, there was 34,272 patients in the studies that they reviewed, that there was a relative risk reduction of 17% for total all-cause mortality. There was a reduction of 28% for heart attacks and 22% for strokes. That sounds pretty good.
Right.
For a drug that's very safe and has, you know, minimal side effects and only really rare serious side effects. So the risk benefit, you know, appears to be there. But then they said the authors in the conclusion of the study said that this was a minimal effect and calls into question essentially the utility of using this drug in the general population. So what's controversial is not so much the data they present, which everyone basically agrees upon, but in how they interpreted it. They emphasize the fact that the number needed to treat is pretty high, meaning that in order to prevent one death from people taking statins, in order to prevent one death, we need to treat 1,000 people for 1 year. So that's the number needed to treat, 1,000 people per year to prevent one death. So is that worth it? It depends on your point of view. I think that also sounds pretty good. Further, that's only for deaths, the one in 1,000. That doesn't include people, the heart attacks and strokes that you prevent that wouldn't result in death. So even when you don't die from a stroke, it still sucks to have a stroke, right? So there's a lot of morbidity being prevented as well. And the cost effectiveness is interesting. The recent data shows, not really analyzed specifically in this study, but there are other studies which show that as the statin drugs are becoming available in the generic form, the generic versions are becoming available, the cost effectiveness is actually becoming much greater as well. So it seems like statins, from their own data, they're a safe and effective intervention, although in the patients who are at the lowest risk, there is, you know, an overall a small benefit, which is no surprise at all. So it's just odd that they would look at this data and really spin their conclusions to be negative. Now, they've been very highly criticized from a number of people for their conclusions. For example, Dr. Colin Bagant, a clinical researcher from Oxford, was quoted in an interview as saying, "I object to the conclusions they have drawn from their review. They say there is not good evidence of benefit, but their own data show significant reductions in deaths and cardiac events. They didn't show any increase in adverse events in their review, but they then say the benefit is not worth the risk. That doesn't make sense." That's true. In the own review, they did not show any excess of any serious adverse events. So, interesting.
Have they backpedaled at all, Steve?
No, they really haven't. And this has been played in the press. What's really disturbing is this has been reported in the press frequently as, you know, a new study shows that statins don't work. Kind of glossing over a lot of the details, the fact that, well, in fact, it shows that it does work. And what it's really saying is that the effect is small, but it's only for primary prevention. It says nothing about the effectiveness in secondary prevention or people who are at higher risk. But it's easy to gloss over all of those details and come away with sort of the bottom line is, oh, now they're saying that these statin drugs don't work. Which is just not true, you know, by their own analysis.
I concur, doctor.
But the bottom line is, you know, talk to your doctor about whether or not you need statins. Don't be scared away by the press about this. The data actually supports the fact that they work and, you know, they reduce deaths, heart attacks, and strokes. Doesn't mean that everybody needs it. They've still got to target a population. That's the thing that you need to figure out with your doctors if you're in a population who will have more benefit from it. Let's go from cholesterol to astrology. Rebecca, astrologers have managed to get themselves in the
segue.
News recently.
That's yeah. Really good segue.
Yeah, I try. I try.
The two go hand in hand.
Yeah. Astrology's been in the news quite a bit recently, most notably because of the whole, astronomers discovered a 13th astrological sign, and astronomers discovered the precession of the horoscopes. It's been in the news mostly because of this not new idea that since the horoscope was developed a few millennia ago, because of the Earth's tilt, the stars rise in a different place in the year. And so if you think that you are, for instance, a Libra, like myself, I was born on October 18th, so I always thought I was a Libra, but because when I was born, the constellation that was actually in the sun, or that the sun was in, whatever, was Virgo. So, yeah, it's not a new idea, but some astronomer mentioned it in a newspaper and it hit the internet and everyone freaked out about it. So, Professor Brian Cox in the UK, he is this awesome guy. If you haven't seen his documentary series, Wonders of the Solar System, go and purchase it or download it somehow if you can. It was on the BBC last year and it was amazing. He has a show called Stargazing Live, and he was on it with Dara O'Brien, who we know is a very funny, skeptical comedian. And they started talking about astrology. Apparently, the way it went down was that Dara O'Brien said, "Let's get this straight once and for all. Astrology is rubbish." And then Brian Cox agreed and said, "In the interest of balance on the BBC, yes, astrology is nonsense." Isn't it nice to hear such blatant skepticism? But even, even in very skeptical England, such a comment can't get by without someone crying, "Teach the controversy." And in this case, that someone is the Astrological Association of Great Britain. Such a thing apparently exists. It's a bunch of astrologers and they are up in arms. They are writing letters. They have started a campaign
They're consulting charts. They're doing everything, folks.
Right. They're praying to the stars. I don't know what astrologers do these days.
Well, I think the denial angle could work. It'll work, you know.
It could work. Yeah. It's just funny because they're up in arms and they're basically saying that Brian Cox and Dara O'Brien have been unfair to astrology. And the problem is that they said this on a science program. And when we look at the science, every study that has been done of astrology that has been well controlled has shown no effect, has shown no magical power of astrologers to do anything, to predict the future, to predict people's personalities, to do anything.
Hey, if I say astrology is bunk, can I get them to complain?
In Britain, you can. Maybe yeah. Not the United States.
I think that Brian and Dara are lucky that the astrologers didn't slap them with a libel suit. Maybe they learned from the chiropractors.
God, really?
But it's the same sort of, it's the exact same sort of thing. And for those of you who are new listeners who might not be aware, I'm referring to a few years ago when Simon Singh in England wrote an article in which he called the British Chiropractic Association he said that they happily promote bogus treatments, and they sued him, and they ended up losing in the end, and it was
quite embarrassing
for them. So, but yeah, it's very easy to sue for libel, and this is the same kind of thing. It's a bunch of pseudoscientists whining that they're not getting fair and balanced treatment, when in fact that's exactly what they're getting. All the science tells us that yes, astrology is in fact a load of rubbish. That's a perfectly appropriate way to put it.
And Rebecca, I think it's also appropriate to bring this up on a science show as well. Because what people do is, when they don't have the facts of science at their disposal, they have a tendency to put in pseudoscientific notions in order to fill that void. It's the responsibility of those in the world of science to make sure that those voids are properly filled.
Yeah, and if scientists are silent on issues of astrology, that they'll interpret that silence as tacit approval. If we don't occasionally say, oh yeah, by the way, in case you're wondering, astrology is total nonsense. If they don't hear scientists saying that, then they won't realize, you know, that that's the consensus opinion of scientists. And in fact, astrology is a total unmitigated load of pseudoscientific crap.
And again, this is nothing new. Carl Sagan I think it was in Cosmos, but I could be wrong. There, you can find a clip of Carl Sagan on YouTube if you search for Carl Sagan astrology, in which he talks about the wonders of astronomy, and he compares it to the rubbish of astrology and how astrology in the end just can't hold up to the wonder of what we know through astronomy. Like the fact that we know that nebulas are pumping out brand new baby stars that lurking just behind, you know, these silly constellations. There's so much more to the universe,
right?
And it's so much more interesting. It's perfectly appropriate to compare the two and to point out that astrology can be found lacking.
Well, listen, the good news is my sign didn't change. So I don't have to, you know, change my colors. I don't have to change like what my totem animal is. All those things are going to remain in place for me.
I mean, the thing is what's also funny is how the astrologers responded to this revelation that the Earth is precessing, meaning, you know, it's spinning like a top. It just takes about 26,000 years for it to rotate around. And therefore, yeah, the relative position of the sun and the constellations are shifting over time. So they've shifted just about one sign in the last 2,000 years. Their response to that is, well, that's just not how it works anymore. We just decided that we're locking into place where the sun was 2,000 years ago, and it's not based upon what the sun is in now.
Yeah.
Okay,
and,
which
and
is a non-answer.
Okay.
So just saying, because it's pseudoscientific crap, that's why you don't understand it.
Right.
So
Steve, I'm surprised. You didn't recognize that's a oh, yeah.
That's an oh, yeah response. And also, there's the issue of Ophiuchus, right, the 13th astrological sign.
Ophiuchus.
A 13th constellation that's in the ecliptic that the Babylonians apparently ignored because they liked the number 12 and wanted there to be 12 signs. So they just got rid of Ophiuchus. But if you include that, that makes things even more funky.
Ophiuchus sounds like a disease.
I thought it should be pronounced Ophiuchus because that sounds cool. But
yeah, that's how I used to pronounce it.
But all the sites tell you to pronounce it Ophiuchus, which I don't like.
Ophiuchus them.
You know what I'm going to do, guys? I'm going to start following the gravitational laws that was laid out in the 1800s. So I'm not going to follow that new crap. I don't like
you
it.
You show them. I'm going to start trepanning.
Yes. Trepanation. Cool. Practice
Can
on
I
your
watch?
Friends.
Yep. Just boring holes in my head.
Let us know how that turns out.
Will do.
Now, the reason why there still are people who believe in astrology may have something to do with this next news item, which is about the state of science education in the United States. Guess how we're doing.
Let's see. Not too good. The report card on science came out just a couple days ago from the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And essentially, we are failing.
Yeah.
Just 34% of fourth graders, 30% of eighth graders, and 21% of 12th graders performed at or above proficient in the National Science Assessment. And these numbers are just terrible. I think the primary quote from this article made by Arne Duncan, the U.S. Secretary of Education, he summed it up nicely. When only 1 or 2% of children score at the advanced levels on this test, the next generation will not be ready to be world-class inventors, doctors, and engineers. Absolutely right.
Now, there's one bit of good news in here from reading about this, that the National Assessment of Education Progress, the NEEP, which is just due these exams, the new exams are actually very different. You actually can't compare them to the older ones because they're too different. And I was reading through the description of the exams, and it sounds like they're incorporating a lot of really good open-ended questions, like design an experiment to test this hypothesis, those kinds of questions. So they really are not just testing factual knowledge about science. They're testing the student's ability to think scientifically.
Oh, wow.
But, of course, that means the
I don't believe you.
This data is all the much worse because it means not only do these kids not know basic facts about science, they also don't know how to think scientifically, which is arguably more important than just being able to recite a bunch of facts, right?
Yeah, here's a basic level question they asked 12th grade students. Solve a design problem related to the electric force between objects.
Yeah.
That's a really, like you said, Steve, a very good question, and something certainly science students of grade 12 should be able to do.
But it's also they also ask basic, knowledge questions like,
what's bigger, an atom or a molecule?
Yeah, what's bigger, an atom or a molecule? Or if you start to get into questions, I don't think this test asked questions like, how long does it take for the Earth to go about the sun?
Or what's the atomic weight of hydrogen?
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. No, it talked about design this, predict this, relate these characteristics, recognize these forces at work.
Yes.
And, right, so a really, a good approach, right? A hands-on, roll up your sleeves and get to a lab or get to a computer and get to work kind of science approach.
Right.
That's the best way to learn science.
So it seems that we're slipping, and despite, a lot of attention being paid to science education, just, in Barack Obama's State of the Union address just last night, he talked about giving priority to science education. But it's just not manifesting. In fact, some people argue that the No Child Left Behind thing from George Bush has been really counterproductive. And I can definitely see the effect. Like, I have two daughters in public school and grade school education. And, the amount of time being allotted to science education is very small. And it's because they have to cover so much ground with the things that are covered on the testing, the standardized testing that they're getting. So
it's small and it's rigid, Steve. I have a second grader as well, and she has 15 minutes or 20 minutes to complete a particular assignment. And if it's not done, it's not done. Move on to the next thing. And they say it's formulaic because of that. And it's all tied into funding, and we've talked about it on prior shows and so forth. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about it again.
We've had a lot of school teachers, email us and complain when we talk about science education. It's not our fault. There are some of us who are trying to do a good job, but our hands are tied because of time constraints, and we don't have the flexibility that we used to have anymore. And it's really the system that's failing, which I could see, given what we know about it. So,
Steve, what do you think it would take to get things back on track?
I think we have to completely rethink how science is taught in the K through 12 public school system. Basically, I think we need to teach more like this test is testing students, teach how to think critically, how to think scientifically, how to design studies, how to interpret them, how to isolate variables, how to analyze news stories, and of course, they has to be informed by a basic knowledge base too. You need to have the fund of knowledge, not just the concepts. Those two things work together. So I'd like to see, a science education program that shows how those two things work together to lead to a real functional understanding of science. to be what we would call scientifically literate, and also to excite students so that those students who do have the aptitude will have the interest. I mean, how many potential scientific geniuses are there out there that will never know that they could have excel in a career in science because they were just never turned on to it? They were never excited about science and never motivated to learn about it. It's terrible how much talent is being wasted because we're just failing, I think, to really excite a generation of students about science.
Yeah, it is sad. You know, I think I know this happened with me, that science fiction actually was like a gateway for me to get into science.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Oh, yeah. No question.
Especially hard science fiction.
Cool.
What is that?
Oh, it's the schedule of speakers for Nexus.
Nexus?
Yeah, it's the Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism.
Oh, are you going?
Yeah.
Nice. Tell me, what is Nexus?
What's Nexus? Oh, well, it's an educational conference held annually in New York City. Nexus explores the intersection of science, skepticism, the media, and society for the purpose of promoting a more rational world.
How does that spell Nexus?
What?
How does that spell Nexus? It's N-E-C-S-S. Should be Nexus.
What?
Should be pronouncing Nexus. I not know English so good, but N-E-C-S-S no spell Nexus.
Well, okay, yeah, but
Nexus. Nexus. What's wrong with Nexus? Nexus. I have brother-in-law. His name is Nexus.
You do?
No, but I could. Nexus. It rolls off the tongue.
Your tongue, maybe. What? Nothing.
So who is speaker going to be at Nexus?
Nexus.
Whatever. Tell me who.
Well, scheduled to appear are Brooke Allen, Jay Novella, Steve Novella, John Allen Paulos, Massimo Pigliucci, John Rennie, Todd Robbins, Jennifer Michael Hecht, Eugenia C. Scott, Rebecca Watson, Daniel Carl Zimmer, and keynote speaker Phil Plate.
Ooh, is Death from the Spaceman?
Death from the Skies, right.
Listen, how you do that?
Do what?
Make your voice all bouncy, bouncy like that.
Well, I am a podcaster.
Ooh, it's very nice. Tell me, what is podcasting?
Nexus.
Nexus, sir.
Shh. The Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism, April 9th and 10th in New York City. Go to nexuscon.org or check out our Facebook page and Twitter feed.
Evan, I believe it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is time for Who's That Noisy, and for the benefit of people who are tuning in to us for the first time, the segment called Who's That Noisy is a segment in which I play a noise of some variety that the listeners are asked to guess exactly who or what is making that noise and to send us their answers by posting at our forums. So you can go to the contact page on our website or send it to info@theskepticsguide.org. And give it your best guess. All right.
And what do they win, Evan, if they guess it right?
They win two things.
Jack and
something else.
And you know what goes after Jack. So
bragging rights, basically.
Bragging rights. Yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
I feel.
So it's just for fun. It's a fun segment that we do. And it's always fun to hear what the listener's interpretation of the noises that we play are. So, all right. And we'll play last week's Who's That Noisy?
In the last few months, I've become religious. I've started to believe in God and creationism and intelligent design. And the reason that I now believe in God and creationism and intelligent design is because of Professor Richard Dawkins.
Is that Pope Benedict?
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful if that were the case?
No.
Last week, Rebecca, off air, you actually guessed correctly.
Of course. That's the amazing Stuart Lee.
He is funny. He is very talented.
He is. He's well known for being extraordinarily thoughtful and unapologetically sort of deep, I guess. He's great. I like Stuart Lee.
He's good. You can see a lot of his things on YouTube, his website, and you'll find him all over the internet if you can't otherwise see him. So we highly recommend it. And congratulations to Alvaro, listener from Rochester, New York, who was the first one to guess over email that was Stuart Lee. So congratulations, Alvaro.
All right. Well, thanks, Evan. What do you got for this week?
All right. I think it'll be challenging.
That's a good one, Evan. Now, we're bound to get some questions about why we call the segment Who's That Noisy? Even though we've said it a few times on the show, we still get those questions. And the reason is that my older daughter, who's now 11, but when she was like 3 years old and was just learning how to speak, she would say, "Who's that noisy?" instead of "What's that noise?" And Evan and I just always said that to each other kind of as an inside joke since then. So when we were planning this segment, we were just calling it Who's That Noisy just as a joke about my daughter. And it just stuck. It seemed like a cute name to keep. At least I think so.
I think we all do.
All right. We're giving you that one, Steve.
All right. One email this week. This one comes from listener Greg Brewer from Midland, Ontario, Canada. And Greg writes, "Hey guys, I love the show. I came across this video from a friend who was convinced that they are here. Please help me convince him that he is out of his mind. Alien abduction, sexual assault provided biological evidence of extraterrestrials." And then he provides a link, which we will have on the notes, the show notes for this episode. It's a link to an interview. It's like a TV show about a mother who believes heavily in alien abduction and trying to convince her son, who is a quote unquote skeptic, not a very effective one, I might say, that we are being visited by aliens. And the show surrounds this guy, Peter Corey, and his story. Jay, you looked into this a little bit, didn't you?
I watched the video. It's pretty typical for a like a true believer in UFOs and visitation. So Mary Rodwell is the name of the woman who stars in the show. It's her show. And she's called Australia's leading authority on extraterrestrial phenomenon. And her son's name is Chris Rodwell. And like you said, Steve, like his role in the show is to kind of insert kind of that skepticism that maybe a lot of people might feel. It's a pretty typical role that they have someone play on TV shows to kind of bridge the gap between the person that completely believes it and is talking about it from an informed perspective to someone that might not know about it and is asking the same questions as the skeptic on the show.
Yeah, but the person is not really what we would call a skeptic, meaning somebody who is well-read and very proficient in critical thinking and the UFO phenomenon specifically. It's just a regular guy who is really just not familiar with the whole thing and has maybe an initial either cynicism or doubt about the phenomenon. But he's not really prepared to address the evidence that's being laid before him.
So here's the evidence. The two of them went to this man's house. Apparently Mary knew the man named Peter before they recorded the show. And Peter relates his experience like this. And I'll warn you ahead of time, there is weird stuff in what he related, even weird for me. I was actually kind of like creeped out a little bit by what he said. So just,
And titillated.
Yes, exactly.
and strangely aroused.
Just keep in mind what's actually happening here is that the man is being interviewed in his kitchen. His wife is sitting 4 or 5 feet away. He's in a room with at least 5 or 6 people if you include the cameraman and the other people of the crew there. So here we go. In 1992 at 7:15 a.m., Peter claimed that he felt something the size of a cat jump onto his bed. So he woke up. He sits up. And there is a 9-foot-tall blonde female straddling him, like facing him and straddling him on the bed. And there's also another woman sitting on the corner of the bed. So he's got 2 9-foot-tall blonde, pale-skinned women.
9 or 7 feet tall? I thought it was 7.
I thought I heard him say 9, but I could be wrong. You could say 7, but
it doesn't really matter. So immediately.
Hypnagogia.
Right. This story fits very nicely into what we call a hypnagogic hallucination.
A waking dream.
A waking dream. He gives all the elements. And I also read an interview, not separate from the video, Jay, that we were linked to, but there was another interview with him where he says that he was paralyzed. So it's early in the morning.
Classic.
Diagnostic.
He quote-unquote wakes up from sleep. He's paralyzed. There's a pressure on his chest. He thought it was a cat sitting on his chest. And he has this weird, bizarro encounter with some creatures. This is a textbook case of a hypnagogic hallucination, a neurological phenomenon. It's like a fusion of the waking and sleeping state where he was basically dreaming in this sort of pseudo-awake, you know, fusion dreaming state. And he remembers this now as a real encounter. Again, I know I've said before on the show, I've had these episodes. I get them when I'm sleep deprived.
I've had them. I haven't had sent 7-foot Amazons, you know, approach me in my bed. But you know, I've had, you know,
That would be a nice one. I'm hoping for that. At one point, I don't mean to get too ahead of you, Jay, but at one point he says like this bare-breasted Amazonian blonde woman. I think he said Nordic is what she looked like. Grabbed his head and buried his face in her very ample chest. To which I thought, yeah, your face was in the pillow, dude, and you couldn't breathe. And so you imagined the pillow being this woman's very large breasts. That's at least a reasonable hypothesis.
So he goes on to say that the woman, one of the women is straddling him. She has pale skin, large eyes, and very well proportioned. He continues to go on and say that she pulled him towards her breast and pushed him into her, okay? So she's really pulling him in tight. And then he continues to explain that at that point, he bit her on the breast and believes that...
Bit rude.
Yeah. He didn't know what else to do.
Kinky.
You know.
Wait, that's not even the creepy part, okay? He thinks that a piece of her nipple came off and went into the back of his throat.
Okay.
Right? Now listen, I haven't even started yet, Evan.
I hate when that happens.
Then he says that he tasted a chemical reaction, like a very strong chemical reaction happened in the back of his throat. So he begins to cough from his reaction. Now he says, he goes on to explain to them that he had a very painful erection for six hours afterwards. And then he said,
priapism.
Upon examination of his foreskin, he found two hairs that were embedded into his skin. And he described it. I'm sorry. The video. I'm just reporting on what I heard in the video, okay?
TMI
He
moment.
Said that the hairs that he found were embedded in his skin as if you pressed your fingernail into your skin and it left an impression like it was sunk in a little bit.
Just under the surface, right?
So he removes the hair from his skin, and he said that it was incredibly painful to do this as well. But now what we have, according to Peter, is a sample of alien biology. We have their hair. So he has the hair tested. And he finds out – now, he had a piece of paper that he's reading off of, and they actually show it on the video briefly for 4 or 5 seconds. So he's reading off of this report that he got back from some lab. We didn't name the lab or anything. They found out that the hair came from someone who was biologically close to normal human genetics, but they had an unusual racial type, a rare Chinese mongoloid that is one of the rarest human lineages known that lies further from the human mainstream. There was a strange anomaly with the hair being that it was blonde or clear instead of black that would be expected from Asian-type mitochondrial DNA. And the analyses concluded that the most likely donor was from a light-colored, tall, blonde female, which agreed with the description that he gave.
Which is crap. But basically, so – but you step back a little bit. You see, so the huge evidence for an alien encounter is
– it's human DNA.
It's human DNA. Right. I don't care how bizarre the human DNA is or how rare
it is. It's irrelevant.
It's human DNA. And let's also get this clear. It's mitochondrial DNA because that's what you get from the shaft of the hair. So that's what they analyzed, mitochondrial DNA. So that's a human. First of all, aliens wouldn't necessarily have DNA. They wouldn't have anything resembling human mitochondrial DNA. And it was human DNA. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, Steve,
that's evidence for an alien.
Aliens wouldn't have breasts.
Well, there's that too. But also think about it this way, guys. This guy's wife has dark hair. He gets found with blonde hair on the shaft of his penis.
Oh, God. I thought of this too.
And he has this elaborate story about an alien.
Why was she looking there?
I'm just saying, you got to consider.
Yeah,
they're
married,
this,
right?
This is like the best excuse ever for why you got found.
There you go. And Steve, I felt the
depends
same way.
On who you're married to.
You know, yeah. I almost shut off the video when I realized that it was human DNA.
It's human DNA.
Wait a second.
Come
where are the aliens? You know, where are the unknown proteins? Where's the triple helix I'm looking for? You know, it's like, come on.
Where's the silicon-based life? Whatever.
Yeah, but Steve, according to the host of the show, he has no reason to lie. Why would he make this up?
Yeah, right? Well, why would he make that up?
They make every canard. They go through this elaborate process of doing a lie detector test on this guy. Come on. A lie detector test. So that's mostly bogus to begin with.
More pseudoscience, right?
And then even if you think that there's some utility to it, no, you don't have to think that this guy's lying. He had a hypnagogic hallucination. He had a real experience. He's just misinterpreting it.
That's just it, Steve. And you see that same theme repeated three or four times in this video.
Yes.
Where there's a false dichotomy. The woman says, and I quote, are they all crazy or is this a real experience? I'm sorry. There's a third option there. She says there's no reason to lie. And
That's a straw man. Right.
Right. And at another point, this guy says that if the guy's not lying, there's got to be something there. Well, I'm sorry. You know, there's a third option there. You know, it's not necessary. It doesn't have to be that the guy's lying or it's true. It could be a simple misinterpretation of the facts, and that's where being a skeptic comes in. Because being a good skeptic, you know where the foibles are in human memory and cognition and the logical fallacies. You know the stuff.
Yeah, it happened in 92. You know, think about how many years ago that is.
Oh my gosh, right?
Well, here's what happened. Because again, I've read more about this guy. This guy's apparently had multiple alien encounters. Always a red flag. He's got hypnagogia. Every now and then he has a hypnagogic experience with some kind of, you know, bizarro encounter. And then he didn't know how to make sense of this experience. I've had patients, you know, again, for those who don't know, I'm a practicing neurologist. I've had, you know, several patients who have had hypnagogia as part of either a sleep disorder or whatever. And they are very disturbed by these experiences. They don't know how to interpret it. They don't know what it means. They think they're going crazy. They're very reassured when they find out that this is a well-known and described neurological phenomenon that's, in fact, treatable if necessary. So this guy has this very bizarre, very profound experience, has no idea how to interpret it, and he began to search the UFO literature and the UFO community for answers, and of course he found one. You know, so that's what happened. Is he got then his story starts merging with the standard UFO story and the alien abduction story, and then that contaminates his memory of what happened. And then
exactly, I would bet that if in 92 or whenever this happened, I actually thought I heard 1998, but we're talking a lot of time here. And I would bet that if you examined his story closely back then and now, I think you'd find some striking differences. That's just human memory; it would just morph over time.
I think what happened in 1998 is that he was examined under hypnosis by John Mack.
John Mack?
John Mack.
May he rest in peace.
The infamous Harvard psychiatrist who essentially bought into the delusions of a lot of his patients who thought that they were abducted by aliens. And was, you know, highly professionally criticized for that, I think appropriately so. So, yeah, he got into the UFO community, and now his story is worthlessly contaminated. So we have human DNA and hypnagogia. That's the huge evidence that we're being presented with for alien abductions.
Yeah. Occam's Razor says,
right.
go with the simpler explanation.
So I hope that we answered the emailer's question.
Yeah, I hope so.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics and our listeners at home to tell which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
So
let's begin.
Willing and able.
Here we go. Item number one. A recently published analysis concludes that 100% of the world's energy needs can be met with renewable sources, wind, solar, and water, using existing technology within 20 to 40 years. Item number two. Paleontologists have uncovered the first and only known single-fingered dinosaur. And item number three, a new study finds that, contrary to popular belief, staring at the horizon on a moving boat worsens motion sickness. Jay, go first.
Item number one, regarding the renewable energy sources, existing renewable energy sources would be able to give us the power that we need within 20 to 40 years. The only thing about that item that bothers me is that you're saying existing, meaning that with current technology, with solar collection and wind and like dam energy production, I'm not so sure that we could meet the needs of the world in 40 or where is this, in the United States, Steve?
World.
The world, okay. In 20 to 40 years. I just don't know if our technology exists today to be able to handle the needs for the world in that amount of time. I mean, maybe it's possible to do it. Like if we built a solar array the size of, New York State, sure. But then who would pay for it? So I'm not there's a lot of questions about this one. I think there's it's missing information for me to really give a good answer on. The second one says that they paleontologists have uncovered the single-fingered dinosaur. That's weird. That's very, very unusual from my understanding. I don't see why it wouldn't exist. It definitely could have evolved to have a single finger type appendage. And then finally, the third one, the one regarding the age-old belief that looking at the horizon actually does help with seasickness, and Steve saying that in this news article, it doesn't help with seasickness. And I've tried it on a boat, and from my experience, I've thought that it worked, but that could be just me fooling myself. But I would find that one very surprising if it was wrong, if that happened to be wrong. So I think I'm going to say that the first one is fake, about the renewable energy being able to fuel the world.
Okay, Bob.
Whew. Wow, this one's tricky. I don't feel the way Jay does. The first one, that's quite a wide net that you're casting there. Wind, solar, and water. I think that it kind of makes sense that if you have those three to play with, even though you're limiting yourself to existing technology, that within 20 to 40 years, it could take a big bite out of the world's energy needs. And 100%, yeah, I think so. 40 years is a long time, and I think it can be done. So that kind of makes sense to me. And the second one, the single-fingered dinosaur. I've never ever heard of any animal with just one digit. I would think that the other digits would, I'm sure they would probably still be there somewhere in an identifiable form. But I guess what you're getting at is that there's really only one functional digit here, and the other ones are just totally, probably just completely covered. Odd as hell. I'm not sure what to make of that. And yeah, the third one, I'm having a lot of problem with this. Staring at a stationary object when you're experiencing motion sickness, that has worked for me. I know, I could be fooling myself, but I remember when I was getting certified for scuba, and I don't get motion sick, but I was in a small boat with 15-foot swells. It was bad, and it was really amazing. It really made a difference when you stare. I think I was staring at a light tower or something. Not the horizon, but something that was stationary. It made a very obvious difference. It was very clear that it was helping. It seemed to help me. It was blatant. So it's going to be hard for me to believe that they're showing that this doesn't happen.
And therefore,
ergo, I'm going to say that the staring at the horizon, I'm going to say that one's fake.
Okay, Rebecca.
I'm going to have to go with the crew on this one. And also based on anecdotal evidence, I've stared at the horizon, not for being on a boat, but when I'm car sick, and it works for me. So yeah, that seems really odd to me. I'm saying that one's the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Although I'm inclined to think that the renewable sources of energy one is the fiction, I don't think it's practical that it will actually happen within 20 to 40 years. That doesn't mean the technology won't or doesn't exist, or that we're on the cusp of it being able to exist. It just means how practical will it be, and can we actually initiate it and put it in place? So I'm tempted to think that one's actually science. The single-fingered dinosaur, that's the first I've heard of that. I've never heard of a single-fingered dinosaur before, but I suppose that digits have to start somewhere. Why not a single-fingered dinosaur? And as far as the horizon goes, I have no idea. I know it's a popular belief that you stare at the horizon and it stops it, but the new study finding it, I'll say that the motion sickness one, I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree on number two. Paleontologists have uncovered the first and only known single-fingered dinosaur. And this one is science.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Is it strange that we haven't found more of these by now?
I just don't think there were very many. You know, this may be the only species of dinosaur that evolved in this direction. So, I mean,
what was the selective pressure then for one finger? Or was it just genetic drift?
They had big noses.
Maybe he was flipping the bird at another dinosaur.
And I'm sure that really helped him stay alive.
Yeah, so this is a theropod dinosaur known as Linhenicus monodactylus.
Monodactylus.
Rolls right off the tongue, that one.
Yeah. This is a parrot-sized dinosaur, only a couple of feet tall, unearthed in Inner Mongolia, China, and published on January 24th. In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is, you know, a theropod was like the velociraptors in that same family of dinosaurs. And they think that, you know, this one clawed finger could have been used to dig out, you know, insects or whatnot. So basically it was probably used as a digging tool is what they're thinking.
Mm. Like a nose picker.
Yeah, basically. And Evan, you know, the almost certainly lost the other digits. Not like you start with one and then developed other ones, but this, you know, evolved from theropods with more digits, and then they just lost them over time. But Bob, you said you can't think of any animals that have only one digit. What about a horse? That hoof is one toe.
But I guess I was thinking of a free functional appendage, not something that you're walking on.
Like an arm.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But it is the same process. You know, horses over their evolutionary history lost the digits down to just the one hoof. Yeah. Very cool. Let's go on to number one.
Of course.
A recently published analysis concludes that 100% of the world's energy needs can be met with renewable sources, wind, solar, and water, using existing technology within 20 to 40 years. Jay, you do not buy this one. The rest of you do. And this one is science.
Yay.
Sorry, Jay.
Come on.
Triple high five, guys.
So, this is a thought experiment. You know, it basically saying, is it plausible? Could we do this? I agree with you, Evan. I doubt we actually will do it. There's a lot of practical aspects here. Although, you know, the authors here argue that it's mainly to do with the political will, that if we decide that we're going to do this, we can do it without any further technological advances. This is a study authored by Stanford researcher Mark Z. Jacobson and others, and he says that essentially the system we would have in place is about 50% wind and 50% solar, you know, a little bit less, like 49% of each, and then about 2% either hydroelectric or like tidal systems.
Yeah. Why just 2%?
Because you don't really need this for just the raw energy production, but every system would have a combination of wind and solar, because solar is active during the day. The wind would tend to be more active during the night, but you need something else to pick up the slack. So that you can even out the demand, right? So you can meet the demand. So you need some kind of on-demand generation like hydroelectric to fill in the gaps. So that's why you always have to have that other thing in there.
I figured it'd be more than 2%. I mean, that's a lot of energy produced by the tides, man.
Yeah, but apparently that's all you know, according to his analysis, that's all you would need in order to serve that function of filling in these gaps. But the majority of the energy would be produced by wind and solar. Yeah, he also thinks that the costs could be largely offset because this system would be more efficient. You know, basically combusting fossil fuels is not a very efficient use of energy, that it would be reduced healthcare costs because of reduced pollution, that this would further offset the cost. And, of course, the energy would be cheaper. It's just the cost of the infrastructure. But, you know, he compared it to building, for example, the highway system in this country or, you know, building the electrical grid. He does say we basically would need a new grid. We would need a new, more efficient grid. And this really would only work if you were able to combine energy inputs from a wide area. So you'd need to be shipping, you know, solar-based energy, for example, from sunny states into or sunny locations in the world to less sunny locations. And, you know, he also said the land usage would not be that onerous. You know, we would only use about the footprint of the wind, water, and solar would be only about 0.4% of the world's land. There would also be a footprint from the space between the windmills, because windmills can't be too close together, otherwise the turbulence from one will interfere with the efficiency of the one next to it. So the space between them would take up about 0.6% of the world's land. But a lot of that could be offset because you could farm in between the windmills. So you don't need to be, that doesn't need to be unused land. And also, if we have a lot of the wind offshore, then that wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought experiment. But again, it's yeah. Don't expect this to turn into a reality, though.
Well, if you remember, like I said, sure, with enough money, you know, if you built a big enough solar array, or you know, you put enough money into it, of course, there's an enormous amount of energy being transmitted from the sun that's collected by the Earth.
Yeah,
and I just think I picked this one as false more out of how plausible is it? You know, like how much money would we have to spend, and how big? How much land would these things have to take up, and how hard would it be to achieve?
That's irrelevant, though.
Not a lot, Jay, because, he said the footprint of the wind turbines, which is providing half of the world's energy, would take up an area less than that of Manhattan. That's not that much. The solar footprint, you know, again, would fit within a small patch of Arizona. It wouldn't be that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually less than that for the solar footprint. So it's actually not that much. And of course, it would be distributed. It wouldn't be all in one place. And I thought what's interesting is that this is with existing technology. So it's only going to get better, you know, as solar technology gets more efficient and cheaper to produce, et cetera.
That's true.
You can make an argument that this is a worthwhile investment. Imagine if, say, 30 years from now, we're at the point where we are independent from fossil fuels. We're not, you know, pouring all of those, you know, released carbons into the atmosphere and other pollutants. And, you know, we have a very cheap and efficient energy source. That the payoff in the end, the infrastructure that we would invest in would definitely have the payoff on the back end. But it's hard to convince, you know, governments and companies and whatnot to make those investments up front.
You'd be asking them to rewrite their economies basically at a certain point, right, on a certain level, and that's really a huge monumental.
Yeah.
Plus another problem is that the technology is changing so fast.
Yeah, but it'll change as we do it. And then, you know, you're gonna be turning over these things anyway, so you know, you turn it over as the technology improves. Right. If you're doing it over 40 years, then that's, you know, during that 40 years, you'll be using better and better solar and wind technology as it becomes available. And
probably
by doing the project itself, we'll learn a lot.
That's true. And hopefully, and you got to hope that there's not like a paradigm shift, though, that might even prevent, you know, that would make the work you've done useless. But
you mean
but
like
even
cold
if
fusion?
It did,
No, you're right. But that's always the risk, right?
Yeah, right. It's just more obvious, though, when you're talking about a project on this scale. It's like, oh, damn, there's $1 trillion we didn't need to spend. Damn.
Right, right.
More than that, yeah. But
you got to bite the bullet at some time, right? It's like
absolutely agree.
Buying your next computer, you're always worried that they're going to come out with, you know, USB 4, you know, right, or whatever. There's going to be some major shift in computer technology right after you buy your new shiny desktop, you know. But this is obviously on a much bigger scale. So let's go on to number three.
Which means?
A new study finds that contrary to popular belief, staring at the horizon on a moving boat worsens motion sickness, and this one is the fiction.
Oh, yeah.
The question here was, were you guys going to go with your own personal anecdotal experience as the guide? I was hoping you wouldn't do that, but
it's
you did.
It's typically a no-no.
Science. But in this case,
it was powerful, Steve. It was powerful.
And I agree. I mean, I've also had that experience. And yes, so yeah, the question is: would you believe that your powerful personal anecdotal experience could be wrong? Sometimes it is, but in this case, just to mix things up, in this case, there was a study that showed that staring at the horizon actually works. That people were more steady, that they had better balance on a moving boat when they were fixating on the horizon. So evidence to support this belief. But I think this is one of those situations where this is a really common belief because it's so obviously true. As you say, Bob, you have that experience of getting very nauseated and motion sickness, and staring on the horizon works very quickly and very dramatically. So, you know, anecdotal experience isn't always wrong. It's just unreliable. But the more immediate and dramatic the effect, you know, the more likely it is to be useful.
Right. And thanks for saying nauseated and not nauseous.
Yes,
just you're a pet peeve of mine.
I think it's a good sign that I didn't use my anecdotal evidence to vote against that.
Yes, I do too.
Agreed.
Yep.
Whatever.
And whatever helps you sleep at night, Jay.
Well, but Jay's referring to, I think, his quote for the week.
You know, Rebecca, you weren't really good with the segues, you know?
Hey, I don't. It's
hard,
late.
It's hard to ride those things. You have to balance yourself on.
I know. I've been like kind of. I was trying to think about how I could do the segue, and I did it. So all right, you know, second time I'm not getting credit for a wise decision. But here we go. The quote this week is from by Barry Beierstein, sent in by someone called Matt Yarborough from St. Louis.
Right.
The quote is, anecdotal evidence leads us to conclusions that we wish to be true, not conclusions that actually are true.
Uh-huh.
Barry Beierstein!
Aha. Uh-huh. Flies in the face of science or fiction.
I have stolen that quote from him so many times. I love that quote. It is absolutely true. Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks,
Steve.
Our pleasure.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For information on this and other episodes, please check out our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. Please send any feedback, suggestions, or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org or send us a message on the Contact Us page on our website. Also, please help spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes or your aggregator of choice. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.